Good afternoon. Today I have with me Vidya. She's a coach and an expert on product management. I'm just so excited for this conversation today with her. Vidya, welcome to Managers Club.
Oh, I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. So Vidya is the author of this book, Groundwork. I was reading it. Vidya, this is an amazing book. I really wish I had gotten this before. And I want to ask you about the book. There's so many good things in it. But let me start off first. So today we want to talk about how to get product market fit before you have a product manager, or maybe you don't have one at all. I think that's a really great topic that affects a lot of people. So stepping back a moment, for listeners who may not be familiar with the jargon, like what do we mean by product market fit exactly?
Yeah, it's a great question. So product market fit at its simplest, there's lots and lots of definitions, but it's very simplest. You have developed a product that customers want. And you know this because it's much easier to be able to market your product. People are actually wanting to give you money for your product. And everything about this feels like it's simple in terms of what you decide to do, how you decide to build it, and who you're building it for. And that product market fit simply means there's a product that you are building that meets a really specific customer need, and they're willing to pay for it. That's at the simplest.
Okay. I want to go to the second part, which is people who don't have a product manager. Mm-hmm. And I've worked with a lot of really great product managers, and I've also been in places where I don't have any. Let me start with this. So there are some companies, for example, Airbnb made an announcement that, you know, designers are equal to product managers. We don't need product managers, things like that. What are your thoughts about that?
You know, it's interesting because I'm currently working with, we coach a lot of different companies, but I've got a cohort right now that's 5 early stage companies, and none of them have, there's no product managers. That's not necessarily your first hire. You have a founder, you need a developer, an engineer, a designer. You might go out and get a salesperson. You might even, you know, invest in customer service support. But product managers are not necessarily the first place that you go, because often the founder or the co-founders believe that they know what they want to build and that they can tell people what to do. And so there's so many times in so many situations where product tends to be when you get to a certain stage and you need someone to kind of go then tell the development team what to do, that's when you think about a product manager. So it's sad because I think product is such a still an unknown role, and a role that's confusing, and people don't really understand this. But when you get somebody who really is focused on your customer and who really is the person who is flying that customer flag in the meetings, they're helping you make decisions that are customer backed. That's really the role of the product manager. Now, do they absolutely need designers and developers? Of course. I mean, this is a group that works seamlessly together. But a lot of the time, not having a product manager is hard. But it doesn't mean that you can't have someone on the team do the role of the product manager. So I'd love to kind of share a little bit more about what that means. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, we'll talk about that. So certainly, like at a startup, right, the founders, usually they have the idea. So they can be the product manager. Maybe people wait too long to hire a product manager, you know, if they believe in it. It's kind of because, you know, it's not the first hire. But it's not just startups. Like I said, like Airbnb is like, we don't need product managers. I've worked at large tech companies. I was just working at a very large tech company. And in my organization, there were no product managers because it was thought these are very technical products. Product managers aren't technical. They're not going to be useful or helpful. So can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's interesting because when there's a... So fundamentally, if we talk about what a product manager does, you're coming into a situation where you have a really deep understanding of what the customer needs are. And once you have that, you are translating those needs, what you've heard from your customers, what you're observing, into what should we do about this. Now, a lot of the time for startups, there are a lot of ideas. There's a clear direction on what to build. So founders often feel like, I know exactly what I need. I'm clear on the direction that I want to go in. And so why would I need someone intermediary to do this? Airbnb is interesting. And that is a little surprising. But I think if they have a really strong design team, if there is a really strong sort of sense of listening to customers, then Airbnb sort of grew up by paying attention to surprises in terms of what customers needed. You know, they literally, I remember stories in their early days, you know, kind of switching and being able to focus when they put pictures on board, when they started to think about like how it changed from couch surfing, like what people were really looking for. That was all based on the super deep understanding of what customers are. Now, they've built a culture and an organization that every single person on the team has that sense, has those tools, has the ability and the skill set to be able to think and talk in terms of customer needs, then perhaps they're saying, we don't need a formal role to do that. Now, I will still probably argue about this, but going back to your question, in terms of founders, understanding and translating what a customer does and a customer needs, there's a certain way to do this. I think most startups that we talk to, most founders, get a little tied into, I know what I want to build, and they go down a certain direction, and they are so, I mean, they're passionate, they're convinced that this is the right thing to do. And perhaps when they get into trouble is when customers aren't buying, and what you end up is where we started this conversation. You don't have product market fit, and you've got to throw more and more money. You're building more and more. You're adding more and more features because you're struggling to convince the market that your product is worth buying. The minute you're trying to convince, there's a problem here. And so that goes back then to that translation and understanding of truly what a customer needs. And that's a certain skill set. It's an actual discipline to be able to take and listen observations and the way that you talk to and listen to customers and turn that into an insight and an action based on what that customer is actually looking for and maybe not what they're telling you they're needing.
Right. Okay, so let me ask you about that. So this skill set of product management. So in tech companies, a lot of people listen to Manager Club, you know, are in tech, right? A lot of software engineers have degrees in software engineering, right? And, you know, designers may have degrees in art of some kind, you know, graphic design. But I don't see a lot of people with degrees in product management, right? It doesn't seem to be a formal discipline. It seems also vary from company to company.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's spot on. It's interesting, right? Because as a discipline, and you know, there are some now universities that are starting to offer different product management degrees. I mean, you've got some leading universities coming in, but it's only now, it's only in the last few years. It's one of those disciplines that people can come from engineering, they can come from marketing. You know, I came from a technical background, and it's really the core of this is this passion for solving for the customer. And you often need a set of different types of skills. So it's not as linear. It's not design, as you point out. It's not learning a language. It's not coding. It's being able to communicate effectively. It's being able to collaborate effectively. It's being able to do a little bit of customer research, be comfortable sort of communicating with design. It's really focused on the business and understanding the what, and then leaving the experts to be able to do the how. So let me just give you a little bit more on that. And I think, again, this is where there's some confusion. Product managers are business people. They represent the customer. Their job is to translate what they know and what they believe to be true into concepts and ideas that then can bring in these cross-functional teams so that they can together build a solution. They shouldn't be doing design. They shouldn't be coding. They shouldn't be, you know, doing customer service. But they have little elements of all of these and the ability to bring the right group of people together in order to come through breakthrough solutions because they've articulated the customer needs so well. And we often, the book that you mentioned, and thank you for doing that, We start with what's the customer problem. And you need to spend time articulating what that problem is. There is a specific, we talk about a specific approach and discipline and template to be able to look at that problem in a 360 view. And when you've done that, you haven't talked about a solution. You haven't told people what to build. You're not giving people sort of a set of requirements. You're describing the problem so well that you allow people that sort of brilliance of coming up with solutions that customers would never have thought about themselves.
I want to talk about customers. So I agree. I think one of the great things of a product manager is, you know, they talk to customers and they understand. Now, I've seen this pattern, you know, at some big companies I've worked at. It's like, well, we're just going to do a bunch of surveys, you know, we'll do surveys and surveys, we'll collect data, and that will tell us what we need to do. So we don't actually go need to talk to the customers. We just send them surveys.
Yeah, that makes me so sad. You know, surveys
it's
have
true, right?
It makes me sad, you know, and it's not like surveys don't have their place. I think, you know, what I would say is like there is the place for quantitative and qualitative. Where we'd like to start is much more around the qualitative, so that instead of surveys, you're watching people, like you're watching them in their element. You know, it's one of the, it's well known now, but there's a technique that came out of Intuit many, many years ago. It's from the founder, and he called it a follow me home. And he tells stories right back where he would follow people. He would watch people buy products. And then we'd follow them home and watch them install it, watch them unpack it, watch what difficulties they had. And there's such magic in observing people's behavior. So watching people is where it starts. Then you have a set of hypotheses and you go through and then you ask people, you interact, lots of open-ended questions. You test different theories that you have. Then once you've understood that behavior, then there's an opportunity for surveys, right? When you actually want to prove it with data, when you want to say, and maybe you need a lot of money, maybe you're going to get to an investor, maybe you're going to the board, or maybe you're asking for more money for your initiative. You want to back that up by, you know, some quantitative analysis. Their surveys have their place. They're nice a little directionally. They're nice to prove out a hypothesis, but they're not helpful in insight. You just can't get insight out of surveys.
Okay. Well, let's talk about this follow me home thing. Because yes, I heard that Intuit would do that. And I think it was back in the day, right? Intuit, there were stores where you buy software off the shelf, right? You'd buy a box and they could walk you home, walk with you, you know, and you left CompUSA or something like that. Maybe a lot of people listening to the show don't even know what that is. But now
it's customer,
right? Right. How do you follow someone home or something, if everything's like on Zoom, everything's remote, and yeah. And you know, if I say like share your screen, if people know you're watching them, they might behave differently. How do you even do that today?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, it's interesting because until a few years ago, pre-pandemic, we were very much around, you know, hang out where people shop, and if it is online, you can still kind of go into their homes very easily and sort of watch them, how they would maybe download something and install and what else is on their laptops. So post-pandemic, we really sort of try to get very creative around how do you still have that observation? So some of the things that we do is we invite some exploration. So I always start with, can you just show me around? Can you pick up your camera and just show me around your office? I like to know, like, where are they? You know, are they working at their desk at the kitchen? Do they have an office, home office? What does that surrounding look like? What's on their desk? Are they super tidy? You know, tells you so much about their personality. You know, or are they a pack rat? Like, there's stacks of things everywhere. So just getting to know the person, explore their environment. You can do the same thing in terms of their screen. Do they have 25 different browsers open? Or are things really clear? When you're watching your product, for example, being used, you know, I love to know, like, do they have a notepad? Like, are they, you know, do they have a cheat sheet? Do they have an Excel spreadsheet that are set up? So what else, what are the tools? What else are they referring to? What's their day look like? What's that situation? You can still do all this. You can absolutely be able to have that same sense of understanding. is it as special as sitting next to someone in their home? No, but it comes pretty close if you give yourself time to explore and learn and really get to know the person and why they're doing the things that they're doing, why they're clicking, how is their desk set up? All of these questions can give you such great insight.
That's so interesting. So you actually ask them, like, turn your camera and show me, like, your desk. Are there windows? Yeah, and people are okay with that, generally?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting when people give you so much. I remember one time, you know, we were asking for to talk to about 10 people. And in order to do this, it was in healthcare. And we asked for a screener. And it was an invitation to say, could I get 10 people to come talk to me? And it was a small gift. It was something like, you know, a $50 Amazon card. It wasn't very much. I just wanted to talk with 10 people. But I needed very specific people. So I put out a call. And this is totally dating me, but it was back on Craigslist. And there was an invitation. And in order to be able to be eligible just to even be considered for that $50 card, you had to answer about 30 questions. You won't believe it. I needed about 10 people. I got 1,000 people just filling out all of that data. I wasn't going for a survey. I wasn't going for quant, but I was blown away about how much people will tell you. And I got so much information. I picked the 10 that I wanted to talk with, but I had over 900 other pieces of data in order to look at. So
that's awesome. What a hack that is, right? You offer a big prize and not even that big, $50. And a lot of people fill out the survey anyway. So you got that data, even if you didn't end up calling them.
Exactly.
Wow.
And you'll be surprised by how much people will tell you. It's absolutely amazing. So don't be scared to ask. And I always set it up once you've got to the 10, in terms of just make people feel comfortable. You know, I'm here to learn. This is really important to me. You tell them why. And then you tell them you're not going to hurt my feelings by anything that you say, because I haven't built anything yet. So this is the perfect time to help me think about this. And then you just give them like a license to tell you anything they want. And people want to help you. You know, I have never met yet an interview that people just do not want to help you. And they will tell you so much. You've just got to be ready to ask questions. And that's what a product manager is. That's what their job is, to feel comfortable and to know how to structure it so that you're not leading people to the answer, but instead you're truly uncovering nuggets that you never would have, they never would have told you before otherwise.
Yeah, it's really important how you ask the questions. There's this book I read recently. And yes, if you ask people these kind of leading questions to humor you, they'll tell you what you want to hear, but it's not really the truth. You know, they'll lie to you. They'll say, yeah, I'd buy this product, but they would never really buy it.
Yeah.
They're just saying it to be nice.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I'll give you one other quick story, which kind of really speaks to people will tell you. This is another Intuit story. But we were looking for this opportunity. It used to come up a lot, this idea of budgeting. And of course, we have all this financial information. We're a financial services company. And we believe, because people would tell us all the time, of course I want a budget. Because, you know, aspirationally, you're kind of supposed to, right? That's what you've been told.
Right, you should, but they don't really
you help. Should. And so people would say, yes, absolutely. You know, of course I would do that. And this is the way I do it. Not one person actually does it. Like nobody, no human likes budgeting. And so, you know, this is where you've got to be so careful and you've got to ask around. You've got to talk about behavior. You've got to about attitudes. You've really got to think about what people actually do and not what they necessarily say, because people will, again, they will tell you everything, but they want to please you and they don't want to look bad.
Yes.
So this is why structuring the conversation is so critical.
That's true. Yeah. They don't want to look bad, right? So they're not going to give that up. So you are so passionate about product management. This is great. I just love talking about this. We could talk all day about it. Let me ask you this. If there's one myth about product managers, okay, that you could debunk right now for everyone on this show, what would it be?
Gosh, that's such a good question. A myth about product managers, that there are project managers. That's the biggest problem I think product managers face, that they are somehow seen as the people who are responsible for dates, as the people who are responsible for getting things checked off and getting everyone completing a project for a deadline. Now, that's not to say I love project managers. I think the world of them. That's a very special, specific skill set that gets training, but it's not a product manager. And a lot of the time, people think of them synonymously, and product managers are put into positions where they are being asked to do work that isn't in service of the business and it isn't in service of the customer, because they're asked to do this project role. So if we could just separate those once and for all, and it doesn't help that they sound the same, so people kind of, you know, interchange them. But the way that
PM, right? Like, is it the programmer, product manager, project manager? Who is it?
Exactly. And there's such different roles. Now, project and program, it's a little easier, right? Because project is very specific, program is multiple projects. But product is a completely separate role altogether. But there's elements of, we're still bringing people together, we're facilitating conversations, you know, we're working towards a launch, perhaps. So there's certain elements that I can see why people get confused, but it's the most harmful myth, I think, that's out there. So that's the one if I could wave my magic wand, I would get rid of that.
Got it. Okay. So we're talking about people who maybe founder, right? They haven't hired a product manager yet. They have a lot of things to do. They have to go perhaps raise money or do a bunch of other tasks. And engineering managers are sometimes tasked to be the product manager, but they have a lot of other tasks too. So in this scenario, assume that you're an entrepreneur or an engineering manager, and you only have maybe 4 or 5 hours a week to actually be a product manager, okay? How would you prioritize that time to achieve product market fit?
So the first thing I would do is if you can build in time with your customers every single week, and you, founder, development manager, bring a small team together and build in that customer centricity. You know, we come into very large organizations sometimes who are trying to make everyone customer centric, to try and bring that understanding of that customer into their day-to-day. But if you, as a founder or a development manager at a startup, at an early stage company, if you can build that into the DNA of your company right from the start, you're going to avoid any sort of, you know, big culture changes and big change management projects, because everyone already does it. And you, as the development leader, as the founder, set the example. You bring the customer to life every week in your staff meetings. You start the meeting by talking about what you've learned from your customer. You connect the decisions that you've made to why it's important to the customer. A lot of the time we connect these decisions to deadlines, to competitors. We talk about, you know, financial goals that we have. We talk about mandates that we've got from the board or elsewhere. But I don't often see a founder or development manager starting with, here's what we've learned and here's how this learning is impacting what we do. And if you do that, it really shows that there's a deep understanding of what's important. You're always connected to the person that you're serving, the person who's buying your product. And that becomes a pattern for everyone else. I would say that's the best thing that you can do. And in that 5 hours, find some time to talk to customers, find some time to talk about it as a leadership team, and then always start your meetings with some learning about the customer. I think that would just set you up for success.
That's a dynamite suggestion. You know, I don't think I've seen that, and I'm guilty of not doing that as well. I think that's just a fantastic idea you have. Are there any other kind of, in this space of, you only have a little bit of time, are there any kind of like grassroots strategies, guerrilla tactics, hacks that people could do?
I'll point you to anyone who's interested, you know, all the templates that we have, we make freely available. And there's a way to think about your problem, the problems that you are working on, that really pull the solution out of it. And when you do that, when you describe a customer problem, you unlock the ability of the rest of your team, who are all smart people, to be able to start thinking about solutions. And I'll tell you, I know that we focus more about sort of the lack of product managers. I think one of the things that I see that is probably the most problematic when you do have a product manager is when they tell people what to do. And instead of explaining what we're trying to achieve and the outcomes that we're trying to get, they turn it into a list of, and now this is what you have to build, which basically, you know, turns off the creativity in your organization, and it doesn't unlock sort of and unleash the creativity that so many developers have, so many designers have, etc. So I think being able to frame what you're doing as a problem and then invite people to come in and help you with solutions. And founders do this all the time too. They get an idea, they have a solution, and then everything's about building the solution versus they have an idea, they talk about the customer problem that they're solving, and then include people in building that solution. And then the second hack I would say is that we've got this template for a really sort of more psychographic profile of your customer. So you start to understand how they think and their attitudes, their beliefs around the product area. And we literally, when we were all together and we were working together, we would have pictures of our customer on everyone's office or cubicle. And I would say, as we're working remotely, you know, actually like laminate a picture and send it out. Have people actually look at the customer as they're building, as the work that they're doing, because then you're always including the customer in the work that you do. It's such a simple hack. It's so straightforward. It's just literally a one pager, but it just brings it in. You just have them top of mind all the time because you're looking at the picture of your customer. And as you're doing the work that you're doing, you are never making a decision without considering how it impacts your customer. So second hack.
Both of these are dynamite. I really love that idea of having the picture of the customer, right? Like who has that? I think that's great. And you're absolutely right. Like lots of times you'll see the founder or, you know, product manager will come and say, well, you know, here's my RFP, RFD, whatever, some kind of document. You know, I went and go talk to the design team. Here's the design. Can you please go build this? You know, and it's like, oh, okay. You know, because I already talked to the customers. This is what we need. So I've seen that for sure.
Yeah. It happens all too much. And then in other organizations, if it's as they get bigger, it's often the sales team or it's the account management team who work with the customer all the time. And your sales team will come in and go, I know what they need. And, you know,
yeah,
in that position.
Yeah, like, yeah, just build this. In fact, we already signed the contract.
Yeah, I've already sold it.
We need it on October 1st, and this is exactly the feature we need.
That's exactly right. And then, of course, I'm sure there's many, every single one of us has horror stories about that. But I think a really easy way is just to help them break it down to the problem. And then you're doing it in partnership. You're not putting them on the spot. You're not saying no, which is never fun. Instead, you're like, hey, that's a really interesting solution. Why don't we just go through this like simple template and figure out, like, you know, just to make sure we're all on the same page with the problem. Anytime you do that, we found that there's multiple interpretations and there's guesses and there's hypotheses, which then lead to that testing, right? It leads to those open-ended questions. Maybe it leads to some observation. Maybe it leads to picking, you know, one of the two or three problems that you have uncovered in that conversation. And, you know, the beautiful thing is it doesn't take very long to do this. This isn't months of work. This is can be done in hours. And so why would we not, right? Why would we not take the time to make sure that we're truly solving the most important customer problem there is?
Okay. What do you think are the most, you coach people, you guide them on this process. What are some of the most common mistakes that entrepreneurs and development managers make in this area?
Yeah, it's interesting. I still remember this happened in our early days of coaching. And I've talked about this problem statement. So we had two co-founders and they had some early success. And they came to one of our workshops because they were, you know, in a place where they had to make a decision about where to grow next. It was a roadmap decision. And they had good reasons for doing, you know, both of these directions. And the co-founders were fundamentally disagreeing. And so we had them sit down and we had them write the problem statement separately. And then we had them read them to each other. And they were solving different problems. So no wonder they were arguing about where to invest and what to build and where to go next. Because they thought they were on the same page, but they weren't. And it sounds so simple, but that is the most common problem that we see. We actually were at a company. It was a B2B company, and, you know, successful. And they had a launch date. When we came in, we were there sort of early March, April. And they had a launch date that they'd committed to their customers for October. It was early fall, and they had promised a big release. And so we actually used that product, even though they were well on their way to building it. We still went back and we did the work. And as we uncovered and we did some hypothesis testing and we went out and researched, we found that there was a much bigger customer problem. And in fact, the one that they were building was one of those, the customer said, yes, 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 that's nice to have. Yes, I'll buy that. But it was just the next version. And they were worried, and this is the reason they brought us in, they were worried about whether this was going to increase the amount of money or if it was just another feature and they weren't going to get any more revenue out of this feature. That's the reason we came in to sort of help them uncover. What happened was that we found this completely new customer need. So they actually did an incredibly brave move. They stopped production, complete development on the path they were on. They communicated with their customer about this. They pushed the new release out to the following year, and they started building around this need, which was a huge success, which worked, you know, incredibly well. But that takes guts. Like when you're down a path, when you invested 3, 4, 5 months of development, and you're expecting this to be a major product in your portfolio, and you turn around and you say, no, that's not going to happen anymore, that's huge. So, you know, just examples of if you're not solving the right problem, that's fundamentally it. And so many people don't want to focus on that. You know, it's funny. People just don't want to. It seems like it's going back to basics. But in our perspective, if your foundation isn't right, then why on earth would you build on top of it? So check that your foundation is solid and it really is something that, you know, customers are actually wanting. So that's really the biggest problem. And it's not just with startups and early stage, it's all the way through to Fortune 50. And everyone does this because we all want to build. We all want to release software or build new products, whether it's tech or non-tech. The fun part is building. All the hard work underneath it, which is defining and strategy and making sure that you really truly understand the problem, that's unseen work,
right?
But, you know, exactly. You don't get points for that.
Yeah, it's unseen, right? An actual product you can see. I love the example you gave. I remember reading that in your book about the two founders who wrote out their convergent problem statement, and it was totally different, right? And to your point, yes, I think it's very important for startups to be able to pivot. And luckily for them, you actually found the bigger problem. But, you know, I think that's fine. I think if you're going in the right direction, right, then you can actually make contact with customers. Then you can find out what their problem is. So that's what I do. I'm doing a startup now and I had one before. So, you know, you got to get in the conversation with them. And then once you've made contact with them and, you know, maybe your excuse is a product that's not exactly the right thing. They'll tell you, you know, that's nice, but here's really what my problem is. And you go, ah, okay, thank you.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that I think is another great hack for this is when you show them sort of three slightly different versions of your concept. And so instead of it being one, you find, and think about the problem and get creative, come up with a few. Because then people find it easier to sort of compare and contrast. And I like this piece, but I don't like that. And then you can kind of figure out why. When it's one concept in front of them, you know, it's very linear and you don't have any options to compare and contrast. But when you do three, It's you suddenly sort of, I find you kind of break through to again, a deeper understanding about what truly matters, because people, when they're comparing things, can tell you why they love something more or hate something more than this other piece of the product or the concept.
That's really great. Yes, exactly. They can say, you know, I like this part of number one, and I like this part of number two, and that part of number three. So you can kind of put it together. Well, you're right. If you just show them one, it's like, well, okay, I guess it's good. what is the hard question, the one thing that most startups, founders, or, you know, engineering directors and stuff avoid asking or confronting, you know, when it comes to product market fit?
I think the really tough question is, when you have some early success and you do have customers that are buying, but it's not necessarily product market fit. And I think recognizing that is one of the hardest things to do. Because when you have zero revenue, that's pretty easy, right? I mean, it's like you clearly haven't got a product that people want.
Pretty clear, yes.
You know, it's very clear, yeah. It couldn't get more clear. But when some people are buying it, but it's not growing in the way that you would expect, your efforts around, you know, and a lot of the time it's like, oh, we just need to spend more money on marketing. When you find yourself saying that, that's the time to pause and go, wait a second, is the problem truly is marketing, or what is it? Do we have a value proposition that truly resonates? And I think it's very hard, especially when you've got some revenue, to really push and look at that objectively, because you got to turn off sort of a revenue spigot if you're wrong. And it's much easier to continue to build on it, to add more features, to pour more money into marketing, than it is to kind of go back and say, did we get this right from the start? Or is this a big enough problem for enough people? Or have we kind of like saturated it? Like, we found a few people, and then you kind of become sort of this custom development shop for a handful of customers, which is not what, you know, you started to build this product for. I think that's the hardest question to face. So yeah, a lot of the time we see companies that are trying to raise, and that's when we take a really hard look at, do you actually have product market fit? And most of the time, the answer is no. Because when you do have product market fit, it's much, much easier. Revenue does come, and then you can actually see all those numbers, the conversion numbers make sense, because you are actually meeting a person's need. And then real magic happens when they start telling other people. And you don't have to spend that much money on marketing at all, because they're doing your job for you because they love your product so much.
I think that's really great. Yeah, that's really interesting. If you have some success, but not all the success, you know, like, how much is it? Okay, we need to spend more in this direction. You know, it's like, so is it, we're in the right direction and we need to, like, okay, we just persevere and do a little more, we're going to get there. Or actually, are we not really in the right direction? So to that point, let me ask you, what would be the signs and indicators to someone, you know, a founder, that they're, you know, on the right path or not in this case? Like, what would be the metrics to look at, maybe?
I think, you know, some of the metrics are, you know, the normal ones, like, you know, your cost of acquisition, you know, what your conversion rate looks like, what your funnel is. You can take a look at all of those. I also think it's, you know, are you look at your product roadmap, and do you have a set of features? Are you adding more and more functionality? Because you believe that just adding X, Y, Z more functionality is going to make a difference. So if you've got a pretty bloated backlog, if you've got a complicated roadmap, if you don't have clarity around exactly who you're serving, that's another sign that you can take a look at. That's an easy internal sign. If you're overturning decisions, if you are arguing about which direction to go to, if you believe it's another segment of customers versus, you know, do you have the depth in the customer segment that you're serving today? Those are all kind of indicators that something's not right, and you should go back and sharpen your pencil around product market fit.
Okay. Another concept in this space, it'll be like MVPs. You know, it's like, okay, we'll build like an MVP and we'll put it out there and we'll get some feedback. And then based on that, we'll know if we're on the right track or wrong track or whatever. So how do you know if your MVP is like viable enough to do that? Is that even a good strategy? What are your thoughts on, you know, okay, we'll just build an MVP and now we'll see what happens with it.
You know, one of the things that we like defining MVP instead of a minimal viable, we like to think of it as a minimal lovable product. And so we're just going to like rename that for a second, because a lot of the time, you know, you're not building out the full function set. So there, it does make sense if you have uncovered a need to build something specific after you've built some concepts and prototypes and so forth, and you're fairly confident. You have to start somewhere. You have to launch with something minimal. Now, you know, and I actually kind of give you a story where I met this company a couple of weeks ago. So it's pretty recent, and they put out two different MVPs. You know, they're working very quickly. They have a lot of, they're AI, so it's very easy for them to sort of throw out some different concepts out there. They had two different concepts. They learnt and they were going to shut them off. They had two or three customers for each of these. One of the products, when they were told, and they did a very nice job of setting up this as it's an MVP, it's a test, we're just learning from this and so forth. One of the CEOs that was a customer of one of these products rang them as soon as they got that email, rang them and said, what size check do I need to write you in order for you to keep going on this one? Now, that's super interesting, right? I mean, like talk about sort of like, you know, making this work. Now, our guidance to them was you've got to be super careful. You know, I talked about being, you know, you don't want to be a development shop for one company. You've got to prove out that this is actually a need across a much broader group. But there's nothing like someone writing you a check to show you that you have solved a big problem for them. So that's probably the most telling. So coming out with a feature, people will forgive so much when you get a part of the problem right, and then they'll trust you to get the rest of it. You know, I'm embarrassed to say I've put out products that there's holes in them. There's lots of things that don't work, but we met one important need, and then they trusted us that we'd fix everything else, and then we'd get to parity in these other areas with competitors. But what we outlined was, here's the need that is not being solved anywhere else. And that is what they trusted us and bring us into their organizations to do. So that's again, sort of other signs to look at.
Okay. We had talked, like one of the things that the good product manager does is, you know, they talk with the customers, they look at these problems, they come up with some insights. So how's a way that you, if you're an entrepreneur or an engineering leader, can develop your skill at, you know, coming up with insights, you know, coming up with these ideas. You know, we have people in the industry, it was like, you know, like Steve Jobs, you know, wow, I came up with these brilliant ideas, you know, but like, you know, if you're not Steve Jobs, you know, what can you do to come up with these brilliant ideas?
Okay, so a couple of things. Like, first of all, Steve Jobs actually watched customers all the time. I think it's like this misnomer that people, now, he didn't listen to what they necessarily said, but he watched them. He went to so many sessions when they were developing their products, and he absolutely took a ton of customer feedback. Now, again, brilliant. So the translation of what they said to, now this is what I'm going to do, it's not linear. So how do you get that? How do you get to insight and then to these breakthrough solutions? You just can't do this alone. So we're big believers in like enabling cross-functional collaboration to look at different things like analogies and other parts of different industries from yourself. Go have and look at different experiences. You know, bring in ideas from other places. And then together, like if you can, again, you know, we talked about bringing the customer in and having that part of the DNA. I think collaboration is another really important part of that kind of culture that allows those breakthrough thinking and ideas. So when you get, you know, ideally when you've got, you know, different, you know, diverse thinking, a diverse experience, and expertise coming together, and you've got a clearly defined problem to solve, there's lots of techniques that we use. We employ design thinking techniques all the time to unlock creativity. But that's the key, a clearly defined, like, what is it that you're solving for? And then a group of people that feel empowered to come up with really crazy solutions that then you can hone in and you can test and you can interpret and you can get to a place where this is something really interesting in you. Now let's go put this in front of the customer and get some feedback.
You coach people. And mm-hmm. so I wanted to ask you, like, when you think of mentors, coaches, or pivotal figures in your journey as a product manager, is there any particular advice or wisdom that, you know, influenced you?
Yes, so many. You know, and a lot of the customer thinking that my business partner and I have started with Intuit. We were, you know, so fortunate to learn from some incredible people. And I think, you know, when I think back to things that really sort of impacted me, it's that say do. You know, we had us, you know, our GM who became CEO of Intuit, he would come and watch customers with us. And that's so incredibly inspiring to have someone who actually sort of walks the talk, would sit there, it's spending the time doing that. And so for me, it's so that deep interest, that showing up and, you know, really putting sort of your words into action. And I think the people that I've learned from the most kind of show me as well as tell me. And so it's that practice of learning from people who take their time to kind of walk alongside you and show you how it's done. And I've been lucky to have so many people like that.
Okay. Your book is really amazing.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed reading it a lot. I highly recommend it to everyone. Besides your book, which is really great, and what I like is very actionable, you know, it's very practical, which is really good. Which other books, or maybe single book, maybe has profoundly influenced you that you might recommend to people who want to develop this skill set?
I think one of the leading thinkers in product management is a gentleman called Marty Kagan, and he has been in product for a really long time. And he wrote one of the first books I read, you know, over a decade ago on product management, and it's called Inspired. And, you know, he's got a very specific way of thinking about product management, but it's a way to think about the craft and the discipline of product together. And so I always recommend people start there. You know, our book is very specific. As you say, it's very practical. It's designed for product teams and founders and entrepreneurs who want a way to get very quickly into, this is how I set the foundation for a product. But we're not really going into, you know, all the aspects of product management and how to work with people and how to think about lots of different aspects of working with development and so forth. And Marty does that. And I think that he writes really well. I think he put out his second edition of the book quite recently with lots of examples. So that's where I point people to start with.
That's a fantastic book. I know an engineering leader who's very strong in product management, and she came on the show and recommended that book too. That's a great choice for anyone. All right, as we're wrapping up, I'll ask you one last thing. For all the aspiring entrepreneurs out there and all the engineering leaders working in corporations trying to, you know, make products without a product manager, okay? If you could give them a challenge or a homework to do next week regarding their product market journey, what would it be?
Oh, gosh. Easy. Go talk to a customer. Go get in front of a customer. Don't whether you're following someone to sales, if you haven't got a direct access, whether it's a prospect, if you haven't got a customer yet, but you directly, not someone on your team, but it's you. Go and talk to a customer and figure out a way to do that in the next week. That's the homework.
Sounds great. Vidya, you've been super generous with your time. It's amazing to talk with you about this. I really love this subject, and I hope it will be helpful to everyone listening. If people wanted to connect with you afterwards, follow up, ask any questions, what would be the best way?
Yeah, my our website, you can, there is productrebels.com, or you can reach out directly to me on LinkedIn. Those are the best ways. And I really enjoyed this conversation, so thank you.
Thank you. All right, I'll put links to those in the notes.
Thank you.